Of Biblical Economics, Part 11. Once again, I don't know how long this series is going to be. Whatever the Lord gives me, I do anticipate it's going to be probably about twice as long as it already is, and we'll see how much longer. As long as the Lord provides, we'll continue to go with it. Again, Principles of Biblical Economics, Part 11, with a primary text having been and will be today as well, Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 22, which says, "The blessing of Yahweh, it maketh rich, and he addeth no sorrow with it." We can praise God. Another thing that we can praise God for, that when he maketh us rich, in whatever fashion it is, whatever wealth he gives us, and we are wealthy already beyond measure. You take 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and 2 Corinthians chapter 6. There's three or four verses in each of those two chapters, and talks about even when everything's going wrong, even when we're poor, we're still rich. And I forget all that's stated there, but even if that's all we have, that is the abundant life. Everything else is on top of that, is again, cream on the top. But that we are witness to the world is when everything else is falling around us, we're still blessed. We can still walk around with our heads held high and with a smile on our face. But of course, we're talking about wealth in a different sense than that. And whatever wealth it is, when God gives it to us, he brings no sorrow with it. Thus far, we've discussed four principles of biblical economics. Number one, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Everything else is added to us. Number two, seek wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Number three, seek work. And number four, tithing, free will offerings, and charitable giving. Now, before moving on to principle number five, I need to make a quick correction to last week's message. I wish you'd have done it during the message. I wouldn't have minded. I was trying to get it out of you because of the way some of you looked. So I'll take care of it now. But I was wrong about the quote-unquote reinvestment of monies from a house sale. It's the profit that has to be reinvested in order not to suffer the consequences of the tax situation, and not the entire sale price itself, and not necessarily... does it have to be reinvested in a more expensive home? Although, that's normally what people do. If they sell one home, they're normally going to get something more expensive and reinvest, quote-unquote reinvest, in another home. Nevertheless, with that correction having been made, the point still stands. Let's recognize that, and that is that the system is set up to keep you in debt. That is, a slave, a perpetual slave, to the system. And the point still stands as well, that slavery can hardly be called a good investment. You simply cannot borrow your way to financial success. Or another way to say the same thing is, you cannot slave your way to freedom. And that's what debt is. Now, Lord willing, we'll be talking more about debt in some of the upcoming messages. However, before going there, I want to talk about biblical economic, what I've labeled biblical economic principle number five. That is efficient and effective time management. I asked you at the end of the last message how many of you knew that the Bible speaks of time management. And I don't recall that any hands went up. But let me assure you that it does. In fact, it does in quite a few different places. Following are a few scriptures. I won't deal with all of them in this message, and maybe we'd call them more than a few by the time I'm done here, but at least a few, if not several, scriptures that admonish us to use our time wisely, and especially as it pertains to the kingdom of Yahweh, which takes us right back to biblical economic principle number one, and that is seek first him and his kingdom above all else. So this all ties together. The first passage I'd like to look at is Romans chapter 13, if you'd like to turn there. Romans chapter 13, and would like to read verses 11 through 14. Romans 13, verse 11, it says, And knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting, drunkenness, not in chambering, and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Yeshua the Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. Now, there's much more being dealt with in this passage than time management, but don't miss the fact that time and time management is being dealt with in this passage. Note verse 11 again in the phrase that says, "And that knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of thy sleep." Now, he's not talking about sleep is sometimes used for death here, and we're going to see the same phrase used in another spot here in just a minute. And it would almost appear as if he is talking about death, but he is not talking about death. He's talking about sleeping away your life, and especially in this particular case, in this passage, sleeping away your life, wasting your life as it regards the kingdom of God. But the fact is, he is talking about using time correctly. That's nearly identical. That particular phrase in verse 11 is nearly identical to what Paul wrote to the Ephesian Christians. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Chapter 5 and beginning with verse 14. Listen and note how verse 14 is very similar to what we just read in verse 11 of Romans chapter 13. Verse 14, it says, "Wherefore he saith, Awake, thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead." Now, he's not talking about there is no way that we can arise from the dead ourselves. Only God can raise us from the dead. So he's not talking about that. But he's comparing this sleep, this attitude that is so prevalent today in so many ways, he's describing that as almost as if it's a death. "Arise from thou sleep, and rise from the dead," he says in verse 14. Is that where I started, verse 14? Verse 14, let me just read it again. "Wherefore he saith, Awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise." Notice he's describing the foolish and the wise in this regard as well. And then verse 16 he says, "Redeeming the time, because the days are evil." It's interesting that he says, "Redeeming the time." Why? Because the days are evil. In other words, when the days are evil is the time when we should especially make the most of our time. Most people slow down. The fact is, most people slow down, relax, or give up altogether when the days are evil or when the economy, for example, has gone sour. They usually give up. They relax. They sit and they wait for better times. But those who are wise will view the quote-unquote bad times as simply an opportunity for advancement and or getting more accomplished. That's exactly what they become. While the rest of the world, at least those who have learned to live or think outside the box, while the rest of the world sits on their laurels waiting for better times. The majority of the world is sitting during the bad times, during economic downtimes, are waiting for better times. They're depressed. They don't see the opportunities. But the fact is, millions were made. Millions were made during the Depression for those few who could see the opportunities during those bad times and who thought outside the box that the majority had themselves in. In fact, the truth be known, the Depression was caused for that very purpose, in order that a few could make millions off the bad times. In other words, with the bad times, quote-unquote bad times, bad as the world looks at them, but with the quote-unquote bad times that we are very likely facing and probably at least in all of our lifetimes, maybe as bad and if in bad, probably even much worse than the days of the Depression that some of you even lived through. With the bad times that we are very likely facing, we of all people, knowing what we know and knowing who we know, should view them optimistically rather than pessimistically, and realize, if we'll just realize, that there is more opportunities probably during those times than there are during the good times. Paul repeats the concept of Ephesians 5 again in Colossians chapter 4. And you won't need to turn there, but Colossians 4:5. He says the exact same thing about redeeming the time. He says, walking in wisdom toward them that are without or outside, redeeming the time. So twice in the book of, in the New Testament, in the epistles of Paul, he uses the term redeeming the time. Well, what does redeem mean? Well, redeem simply means to buy it up or to buy back what's been lost. In this case, we'll talk about it as buying up. Now, you talk about an investment. Find more time in a day for godly and productive purposes, and you will have made one of the greatest investments in life that you can make. And having done so, you will likely thereby rise above and forge ahead of your contemporaries by simply finding more time in a day. Now, you say, well, how can that be? We're all given the same amount of time, right? Well, yes and no. First of all, we are not all given the same amount of days. But we are given the same amount of time in a day. We're on equal footing there. J. Oswald Sanders put it this way. He said, others may have more ability, influence, or money than we, but they have no more time. God has made it all equal as far as what's in a 24-hour day period. We are all on equal footing. You know, I used to say the only level ground is at the foot of the cross. Well, there's level ground at another spot, and that is that God has given us all the same amount of time in a day to use and to utilize for whatever purposes we can. But why is it then that one man can get more time, get more out of the time allotted to him than another man can if the time is the same? Well, because first, he recognizes the value, the inestimable worth of what's not in a year or a month or even a day, but what is in every hour and even every minute of every day. You've heard me share this poem before called Just a Minute, and I don't know who wrote it, but it goes like this. I have only just a minute, only 60 seconds in it, forced upon me, can't refuse it, didn't seek it, didn't choose it. But it's up to me to use it. I must suffer if I lose it, give account if I abuse it, just a tiny little minute, but eternity is in it. There are men who understand that, or close to that, and then utilize it. And therefore, recognizing the value of every minute, hour, and day, secondly, such a man puts them to work for his God, for his kingdom, for his family, for himself, and for his future and his future success. Every minute of every day, if you think about it, is like a talent in the parable of the talents. The only thing is, in this parable, or with these talents, we've all been given the same amount of talents. But every minute of every day is like a talent in the parable of the talents. And some men, like the unwise steward, take those minutes, and therefore often those hours, and sometimes even days, and bury them in sleep, in pleasure, and in other non-productive activities. While others invest those same minutes and hours and days, and thereby make the utmost or use them for the utmost or make the most out of those minutes, out of those quote-unquote talents that Yahweh has bestowed upon them. Twice in the book of Proverbs, in chapter 6 and verse 10 and in chapter 24 and verse 33, Solomon warned the following. He said, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty will come upon you like a vagabond and your need like an armed man. The same is true when it comes to pleasure and play. You know, how much productive time that can be used for the success of a man, a community, or even a whole nation is lost just simply playing or in front of the boob tube or on absolutely other non-productive pastimes. Think about that. How much time is lost on such activities in a day? Just in one life. And then start accumulating all the lives, especially in the day and age that we presently live in. 2 Timothy in chapter 3 and verses 1 and 5. Again, you won't need to turn there, but listen carefully to what it says. It says, "This know also, that in the last days," and I believe it very well may have been talking about some other last days. This is often applied to the days we live in now as being the last days, and I don't necessarily think that's the case, but there is a repetition of last days and the activities of the last days, even if it was another last days at another time. And he says, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truth breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, and heady and high-minded." Sounds like some really scoundrels, doesn't it? Sounds like some of those living today, in the last days that we may very well be in today as well. But you know what else it adds to the list? At the very end it says, "lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, and from such men turn away." Now note, it says to us that not only should we not be involved in any of those activities, pleasures of even the pleasures of men rather than lovers of God, but that we shouldn't even associate ourselves with such people. Now, it goes for granted that we shouldn't be associating ourselves with false accusers and truth breakers and traitors and the others that are mentioned in here. But God says, don't even let the influence of those who love pleasures more than God be such that they have an influence in our lives. Don't be that, but don't even associate with that. Bad company corrupts good morals, and it's bad company to be around those who love pleasure more than they do God. Solomon in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, put it this way. He said, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. And so enjoy yourselves, speaking to himself in a way of speaking. And he says, and behold, it too was futility. And I said, of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? And then in verses 10 and 11, he says, and all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun, obviously, in such things. And then in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 4, Solomon also wrote and said, the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. Now, what's that say about our sports arenas today? You know, and I'm talking about the real fanatics who live their lives there, who everything that they do revolves around sports and the sports world. That's one of the houses of pleasure, right? You know, they're filled with fools, is what the application of what Solomon said would be. Filled with fools. Now, that doesn't mean everyone who's there is a fool, but good chance the majority are nothing but fools. Now, that's not to say, at the same time, that there's not a place for pleasure and relaxation and entertainment. No, but there's a balance, there's a fine balance that we must understand. And in fact, Solomon provides the balance for that as well. He just said, you know, I let myself just get involved in all kinds of pleasure. There wasn't anything I held back for myself, and I found out it's just vanity. Well, watch what he says in Ecclesiastes 4, 7 and 8. He says, then I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without dependent, having neither a son or a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches. And he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This, too, is vanity and is a grievous task. You know, to understand the book of Ecclesiastes, you have to understand that Solomon is usually dealing with the extremes. And he's dealing with, you take the two extremes. He doesn't often talk about the balance in there. He just shares, here's one extreme and here's the other extreme. So find the balance. Because he says both extremes are vanity. Seeking pleasure, and seeking almost pleasure alone, letting your whole life revolve around pleasure, is vanity. But having no pleasure in your life, and just your nose to the grindstone all the time, is also vanity. There's a balance that God provides us in all things, and always what we should be looking for. Everyone needs some relaxation. Everyone needs some pleasure, pleasurable things in their lives, in order to be at the optimum, their optimum, at other times. But again, let me warn you that if you're not careful, and if you don't control this area of your life, let me tell you that it will take over control of your life. It will get out of hand, and it will, like someone who sleeps their life away, it will also control your life, and your poverty will come like an armed man and like a robber to your house. Let me give you an example from my own life. Not that it became an armed robber, but it could have. Today, computers, I don't know how you noticed, I didn't notice until one of my children let me know, but most computer, the programs that come with the computers now, come with game programs on them. They're nothing fancy like the games you can rent from the video stores, but they've got Solitaire, and they've got one called Spider Solitaire, and usually five or six games that are automatically already there. When I get up in the afternoon, or after eating in the afternoon, I need to get the juices flowing again. I'm not ready just to jump right back into it, and so I thought, well, I'll play a game here. I'll just play a game of Solitaire. However, you know what they did with these games? They definitely put the games on there. Not only can you play the game, and not only is there a challenge to beat the game, but then they put how long it took you to beat the game. Or how many tricks it took to beat the game. And so, even if you beat the game, then there's the challenge to say, oh, I bet I can do better than that. I can beat it in less seconds than that. And so there's always this temptation to get back into it. And I found myself, over a short period of time, thankfully, this challenge of wanting to get back in the game starting to rob me of valuable time in my life. I finally realized, hey, Ted, this isn't working. You're wasting time. And so the only way I figured I was going to keep control of it was I simply erased the game off the computer so it could not be a temptation in my life to rob me of valuable time anymore. Hey, much better. Go outside and do jumping jacks. Take a walk. Find some other way to find pleasure, but something that's not going to grab a hold of you and become a master in your life like some of these things can be. You need to control it, or I guarantee it will control you. Parents, don't think your children are going to be able to do this on their own either. Help your children to control their time. I recommend, at the absolute most, that you allow your children to play computer game or whatever it is, only 1 hour out of their entire day. Teach them how to use their time productively in their studies. Teach them the second principle of biblical economics, of seeking and searching and desiring wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. And teach them to use that time productively to for their future and for the kingdom's future. And to limit their time. They're not going to, I guarantee you, they're not going to do it on their own. Limit their time. I suggest no more than an hour a day that they're able to be involved in such activities. Let me tell you, if we don't understand it, the enemies of Christianity do. Listen to Protocols. This is going to be from, of course, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is purported to be the minutes of the first Zionist Congress held in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. Now, whether you people want to accept that's where these came from does not matter. The point that matters is what's found in them, not who wrote them. Okay? Not that there isn't a point in that, but that's not the major point. Listen to Protocol number 13, Article 3, Sentences 3 through 4 in this regard. It says, in order that the masses themselves may not guess what they are about, we further distract them with amusements. What did we learn in the last hour about amusements? Amusements means, the word literally means, if this fellow was correct on this video, means not to think. That's what they want us to do, not to think. Let me read it again. In order that the masses themselves may not guess what they are about, we further distract them with amusements, games, pastimes, passions, people's palaces. A little bit later it says, soon we shall begin through the press to propose competitions in art, in sports of all kinds. Sound familiar? Again, it doesn't matter who's written it. It's come true. Going on, these interests will finally distract their minds from questions in which we should find ourselves compelled to oppose them. End of that quote. In other words, let's get them so involved that they won't have time to ask the questions that we don't want to expose our hand on, that we'll have to oppose them on. Let's just eliminate the questions. Let's get them so involved in amusement parks and pleasures of this and pleasures of that kind and sports. Fill the sports arenas to the brim of with people who no longer have time to think because they're spending all their life on pleasure. Add to that Protocol 5, Article 11, Sentences 3 through 4. It says, there is nothing more dangerous. Listen to this. There is nothing, they said, more dangerous than personal initiative. It has genius behind it. Such an initiative can do more than can be done by millions of people among whom we have sown discord. We must so direct the education of the Goyim communities that whenever they come upon a matter requiring initiative, they may drop their hands in despairing impotence. End of that quote. I wonder how they could keep us from being initiative. Get us so involved in so many other activities that we no longer have time to think or to put what we know and understand to effect. I would say somebody understands as it pertains to this area. And again, it doesn't matter who it is. Somebody understands. Those who hate Christianity are the enemies thereof. Solomon declared something very similar to Paul's admonitions to the Ephesians and Colossians. In Ecclesiastes 9:10, he says, whatever your hand finds to do, verily do it with all your might. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol, where you are going. Of course, Sheol there is speaking of the grave. Time isn't specifically mentioned in that particular verse, but that's what Solomon is dealing with. It's all about time. We are all going to the grave sometime. We don't know when, and therefore Solomon is simply saying that admonishing us to make the most of the time, or what time, Yahweh has allocated to us. That's the whole point. We are going to the grave, and we don't know when. So we'd better. It may be, you know, we know a man here just last summer walked out the door to chop down a tree and never came back. It could be this afternoon. And that's the whole idea. Your time, you don't know how much time you have. And therefore, you'd better make the most of it now because there is no planning, there is no wisdom, there is no knowledge or understanding where you're headed as far as the grave is concerned. Time is a limited resource. There's only so much of it, especially when viewed from an individual basis. And it may be today, not tomorrow, that we run out of it. Kind of reminds me of a story, and I believe I clipped this years ago out of the Reader's Digest, true story of an officer in the Korean conflict. I'll just read this to you. It says, while serving in the Army during the Korean conflict, I was reassigned from combat to training school in Seoul. I had a Korean orderly whose newly acquired knowledge of English often produced results almost as frightening as life on the front lines. He'd wake me each day by loudly whispering, Lieutenant, your time has come. Now, let me tell you, there's something to be learned from that. Maybe somebody should whisper in our ear each morning, you know, Hirsch, your time is now. And if you think about it, that's really all the time we have, for sure, is right now. James in chapter 4 and verse 14 put it this way. He said, you do not know what your life will be tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Turn to Psalms chapter 39. Same idea. I'm going to share a couple passages here from the book of Psalms. Psalms chapter 39 and verses 4 and 5. Here's how David put it. He said, Yahweh, make me to know mine end. He says, make me to know my end. Now, can any man know exactly when his end is going to be unless he takes his life himself? No. But he was saying, help me to get a hold of the fact that I do have an end. You know, too often we think, and especially youth, you know, as if their life is going to last forever. David said, he said, help me to know the fact that I've got an end. And then he said, and the measure of my days, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. Behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth, and my age is as nothing before thee. Verily, every man at his best state is altogether vanity. Or the New American Standard translated as a phantom. It's just a phantom. It's just a breath. He says, help. And man, you start thinking about it. Especially, you start to get a little older, and you realize you're getting closer to the point any day. The longer you live, the closer you are. No matter when it is, you're that much closer. You start realizing, hey, this has been a phantom. This has just been a breath, everything up to this point. You know, I'm nearly 50 years old, and it just seems like it was just yesterday that I was that young boy romping down the fields looking for something to shoot with my BB gun. You know, it's just been a phantom. Help me to know. He's saying, why would he want to know that? Well, obviously to make the best use of whatever time he had left. Because much of it is squandered on youth. Gets nothing done in the process. In Psalms 90, verses 10 and 12, it's put this way, as for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. That's not talking about the rapture, by the way. And then in verse 12, he says, so teach us to number our days. And notice, he didn't say number our months or number our years. He said number our days, that we may present to thee a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days. Think about it in the following terms. Killing time is not murder. It's suicide. Because wasting time is literally wasting life, your life, and my life. And you're the only one who can kill time. And thus, it's suicide and it's not murder. If you must kill time, if you must kill time, work it to death. Get the most out of it. And listen to me, counting time is not nearly as important as making time count. The world is full of people who mark time. Kill time and mark time. And if you want to mark time, you know, just sit behind me and watch the bald spot in the back of my head grow. It's not going to do you any good, but if you want to mark time, that's about how much you can get out of marking time. Don't mark time. Let time help you to make your mark. However, possibly someone's still not making the connection between economics and time management. I hope that's not the case, but just in case, think about it in the following fashion. Life is a system of exchange, right? Life is a system of exchange. We exchange work for money in most cases. Not many of us are born with a silver spoon in our mouth. So we exchange work for money, but what do we exchange for work? Time. We exchange time for work, and we exchange work for money. Let's carry it a little bit even further. We exchange time for work, we exchange work for money, money for food, food for energy, energy for service, and service for blessings. And it all begins with that precious commodity known as time. That's where it begins. Most people start that exchange with work. Oh. You gave up time to work in order to get the money, to get the food, to get the energy, to get the service, and then to get the blessings. However, if the truth be known,
most people spend their time like it's not worth anything, and their money like it is. How ironic, especially in this day and age. But which is worth more? Now, the fool will say his money, even if he has silver and gold. The fool will say his money. But let me ask you this. Which would you rather run out of? Money, your Federal Reserve notes, or time, your allotted time in life? So which is worth more? Can time used wisely and effectively help you to secure Federal Reserve notes? You bet it can. And in fact, if you're especially clever, it'll help you secure some gold and silver too. But Federal Reserve notes, or even real money, cannot buy you 1 millisecond of time. And therefore, let me tell you, how you spend your time is much more important than how you spend your money. Not that that's not important. We'll get to that later on in the series as well, Lord willing. But I'm here to tell you that how you spend your time is much more important than how you spend your money. Somebody put it this way yesterday, and this little saying fits in really well with economics. He says, yesterday is a canceled check, tomorrow is a promissory note, and today is the only cash we have it. Or excuse me, cash is the only time we have. That time-worn saying is true, isn't it? That time is indeed money. And really, much, much more than that. You know, the greatest use of our time is to use it on something that will outlast us. The greatest use of your time. If you want to use your time wisely, look for something that will outlast you. And even time itself, if you're really wise. In the apocryphal book of the apocryphal book, Wisdom of Solomon, in chapter 2 and verses 2 through 5, we have this. It says, we shall be hereafter as though we had never been. For the breath in our nostrils is as smoke and a little spark in the moving of our heart, which being extinguished, our body shall be turned into ashes, and our spirit shall vanish as the soft air. And our name shall be forgotten in time, and no man shall have our works in remembrance, and our life shall pass away as the trace of a cloud, and shall be dispersed as a mist that is driven away with the breaths of the sun, or with the beams of the sun, and overcome with the heat thereof. For our time is a very shadow and passes away, and after our end there is no returning, for it has fast sealed, so that no man cometh again. Let me read verse 4 to you again. It says, and our name shall be forgotten in time, and no man shall have our works in remembrance, and our life shall pass away as a trace of a cloud, and shall be dispersed as a mist that is driven away with the beams of the sun and overcome with the heat thereof. Our name shall be forgotten in time, and our works will not be remembered. That's kind of depressing, isn't it? You know, but you think about it, it's true. You know, how many people, you've heard people use these illustrations before, but how many people can remember who the Super Bowl champs of 3 years, even just 3 years ago was? No, there are maybe one or two. Won't name names. But give it a few more years, you won't remember. I'm not even sure who won it last year. You know? And if I could, what good would it do me? The fact is, how many of your predecessors in your own family line, how far back can you know, and you can't remember any names any further? Most of us can go back to our grandparents. Some of us can go to our great-grandparents. Very few remember any more names beyond that in our own lineage. And the works that they did, we don't know of any of them. They pass as a shadow, as a mist in the darkness. But, let me tell you this, if we have lived our lives, if we have performed our works on behalf of Yahweh and His kingdom, you talk about good time management, that's good time management. If you have lived your lives and performed your works on behalf of God and His kingdom, both our names and our works will be recorded in Yahweh's books of life to be remembered forever. Let me read to you Revelation 3 and verse 5 as it pertains to our names. He says, "He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." Hallelujah. You know, everyone else, by the time my children have their children and their children have their children, I'll be forgotten for the most part. Except with God and his angels, if I've overcome to the end. Also, don't miss that some people are going to be blotted out. We're in and can be blotted out. And then in Revelations 20, 11 through 15, as it pertains to our works, and it says, "And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which was the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell," or Hades, or the boat of the dead, "delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every man according to their works. And death and hell," or Hades, the boat of the dead, "were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was found written in the book of life whoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire." The opposite obviously being true. Those whose names and deeds were written in the book of life were not cast in the lake of fire and would live forever, both them, their name, and their deeds before Yahweh. Let me tell you, what we do with our time is important. And what we can do best with our time is to do something with it that will outlive ourselves and even outlive time, is even possible. In the remainder of this message, I want to share with you now 10 principles for effective and efficient time management. Number one, what do you think number one is? How about, let's go back to the very first biblical principle of biblical economics. Begin with God. Number one, begin with God. The absolute most efficient time management begins with Yahweh. And how could it be otherwise? Think about it. Time itself began with Yahweh. Genesis, very first chapter, the very first verse, the very first four words of the very first verse or the very first chapter says, "In the beginning, God." Begin with God. Matthew 6:33, which is the basis of the first biblical principle of economics. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all of these other things shall be added unto you. In Luke chapter 12 and verses 16 through 21, which is the story of the unwise farmer, if you remember, who was a great, great success in farming, had all of his crops, brought all these his produce in, built barns and built greater barns, and in the end, because he had never sought God through it all, he says, "Now what?" God says to him, "You've lost it all." It provides an illustration of extremely poor management. That guy was a time manager, I'll guarantee you. But he was an utter failure because he did not begin with God. You can be a success in the world. You can be the best time manager that has ever existed and still be an utter failure if you don't begin with God. And it's illustrated in that particular passage. We won't take the time to read it. Efficient time management should therefore begin with God, with time with God, every single morning. Begin with God. The rest of your day, time management. And I know some of us don't like to get up in the mornings and are not morning people. And I've encouraged some of you on this before. You won't name any names. But if you heard that, you could hear the one who laughed loudest. Your whole day should be involved in time management. You therefore must begin with God. Genesis, Abraham was a great example of this. Genesis chapter 19 and verse 20 says, "And Abraham got up early in the morning and to the place and went to the place where he stood before Yahweh." And I'm sure you, like me, believe that that wasn't a one-time occurrence in his life. I think he did it every single morning. He got up early in the morning and started with God. I challenge you to make that commitment. It's a vow if you do. To make a commitment that I will never start a day without my God. You know, I can remember times, and I'm not using myself to boast in any fashion, but I made that commitment many, many years ago. I won't even tell you how many years ago. That I'd never start a morning without God, time in His Word and time in prayer. And I worked for a period of time, I worked at a place where I had to get up at four. I had to get up at least by five, if not earlier, to make it to work in time, which meant I got up at 3:30 and 4 o'clock sometimes to make sure that I followed through by beginning the time with God. Why would I want to do such a thing? Well, maybe it's found in Psalms 19, verse 14. It says, "O satisfy us in the morning with Thy loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all of our days." Do you want to sing? And be glad and joyful throughout your day, then start with God in the morning. There's nothing more important you can do, and time management from that point on is a breeze if you start with Him first, or at least it'll be easier. The second principle for effective time management is organize. Generally speaking, the more time that's spent on planning a project, the less total time that's required to accomplish the same task. The principle is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 10. It says, if the axe is dull and he does not sharpen the edge, then he must exert more strength and usually more time to get the job done. A dull, you cannot get a job done. You cannot get a job done with a dull axe near as fast as you can with a sharp axe. And so the time spent on preparing and organizing and getting things ready usually makes the overall task much shorter. Now, I need people to convince me when it comes to the computer that I should go and I should learn more about the computer so that in the long run it'll be more effective and quicker and faster. I'm not there yet, so this one's for me as much as it is for you. But organize. I'm organized otherwise. Organized. Get rid of the clutter. Off your office, off your desk. It just causes problems. It's unorganized, and you'll never be as effective. Am I stepping on toes again? Edwin Bliss put it this way. He says, if you fail to plan, you will find yourself making the fatal mistake of dealing primarily with problems rather than with the opportunities. If you fail to plan, if you fail to organize, you'll find yourself primarily dealing with problems rather than opportunities. Also, organize with an emphasis on priorities. I think I've shared this with you maybe once before, and possibly you've read it on the internet or somewhere else. But an expert in time management was speaking to a group of business students, and to drive home the point, he used an illustration that his students, they say, will never forget. As he stood in front of the group, he pulled out a 1-gallon wide mouth mason jar. And he also produced about a dozen fist-size rocks that he then placed inside the jar. And when the jar was filled to the top with these rocks, he then asked the students, he said, "Is the jar full?" And the ones that said anything, they said, "Yeah, the jar is full. You can't get any more rocks in it." And he said, "Oh, really?" And so he reached underneath the table, something they hadn't seen, and pulled out a bucket of gravel and poured the gravel in. And he said, "Is now the jar full?" And most everyone said yes. And he said, "Oh, really?" And so he got the sand that was underneath the bucket of sand that was underneath the table as well, and pulled it out and put it in as well. And he said, "Now, is the jar full?" And they all said yes. And he said, "Oh, really?" And he grabbed a bucket of water and he poured the water in as well. And he then said, "What's the point of what I've just done? What's the point of the illustration?" And one student raised his hand and he said, "Well, the point is that no matter how full your schedule, you can always, if you try hard enough, you can always get something else into it." And the professor said, "No, that's not the point of the story." And he said, "The point of the story is that unless you put the big rocks in first, they'll never fit." You know, the point being for us is that we need to figure out what are the big rocks in our lives. what the priorities in our life are and deal with them first. Because if you don't deal with them first, you won't be able to get them in. Figure out what is most important in your life and deal with them accordingly. God, family, your profession, especially your spiritual life, of course that goes with God, your success in life. Deal with everything else accordingly. Pleasure, pastime, sleep, all needs to be relative to the big rocks. Kind of reminds me also of one of Gary Larson's cartoons. I wish you could see it. It's always better when you can see it, but let me try to depict it to you. There was an older couple that was out camping, and Murray is in the tent, and his wife's in front of the tent, and she's got her back to him sitting on a stool, and she's got one boot off, and she says, "Ah, Murray, there's a bug in my boot." And behind her is Murray in the tent, and he's being constricted by a boa constrictor. You know, priorities, lady. Forget the bug. Your husband's being put to death. You know, and so we need to put emphasis in every day of our life on the priorities. Prioritize what is important. Third principle, concentration. People with critical time management problems are often people who are trying to do too many things at one time. They're scattered. I grew up with a sibling like that. I won't name which one it was, although it was the only other male in the family. he was talented to the extreme. But he was so talented, he had all these projects done, and very seldom did he even get them done. And he'd probably admit the same thing to you as well. What really counts is not the amount of time spent on any particular project, but instead the uninterrupted, concentrated time that you're able to put on it. Don't get sidetracked on all the non-essential things that don't need to be done. And so often, it's so easy to get sidetracked onto this little project, and when it doesn't affect the overall problem or the overall desire of what needs to be done. The fourth principle is procrastinate. What? Procrastinate procrastination. Tomorrow is in the realm of the unknown. And if you think about it, possibly even the non-existent. So you better procrastinate procrastination. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 1 says, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you know not what a day may bring forth." And James 4:14 again says, "You do not know what your life will be like tomorrow." So the only thing you should procrastinate is what shouldn't be done today, and procrastination itself. Procrastination is, furthermore, the enemy of your soul. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2, it says, "Now is the acceptable time. Behold, now is the day of salvation." Not tomorrow. Not any other time. Now. You put it off, you may never get to it. Hebrews 3, 7 and 8 says, "Today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your heart. Procrastination is the enemy of untold numbers, hundreds and thousands of people's soul. And it's also the enemy of your success in life. The tragic consequences of procrastination is illustrated in the life of Felix. In Acts chapter 24 and verse 25, when Paul had initially been in prison, Felix, I believe he was a king, it says, "And as Paul reasoned of righteousness and temperance and judgment to come, Felix trembled." He was moved by this and answered, "Go thy way for this time, and when I have a convenient season, I will call thee back and hear more." Never was recorded that Felix ever called him back. He lost his soul in the process. Also, the parable of the foolish five virgins is also an illustration of the danger of procrastination. Following is a good way to avoid or beat procrastination. Eat the peas first. Now, if you're like me, you don't peas or beets, whatever you don't like, that's the illustration. Eat the peas, eat the beets, eat the watermelon first. Yeah, I don't like watermelon either. Get it out of the way. That is, at least only those P's that have a consequential effect upon the overall success of the project. Again, don't get sidetracked on the non-essentials. But if it's an essential, there are things I do every day. First thing, because I will not reward myself to get to writing on a book or preparing a sermon until I've got these other things that have to be done out of the way. Because if I don't do it, it's going to keep me. I'm going to procrastinate them because I don't like doing them, and they're not going to get done. And overall, the ministry will never be as effective as it could be. So eat the peas first. Get them out of the way, or you may never get them done and never get the project done in completion. The fifth principle. How far have we got? About 5 minutes. The fifth principle. We're going to do this fast. Is eliminate time wasters. The Athenians. You remember the Athenians that Paul ran into on Mars Hill? The Athenians are an illustration of time wasters. In Acts 17:21, it says, "Now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time on nothing other than telling and hearing something new." You talk about time wasting. In fact, the Athenians were the forerunners of today's news media. And most talk show hosts, liberal and conservative as well. You know, speaking of nothing but what's new. You know, something that's new. Let's always talk about something new. Getting nothing done. And they're the epitome of that. Paul J. Meyer put it this way. Experience proves that most time is wasted not in hours but in minutes. A bucket with a small hole in the bottom gets just as empty as a bucket that's deliberately kicked over. Usually we're losing time in small increments. You need to apply radical surgery wherever is necessary to your schedule. Examine your daily activities, sleeping habits, your reading habits, TV habits, extracurricular activities, and remove everything that doesn't give you a sense of accomplishment and satisfaction. Now, that doesn't mean you remove pleasure and relaxation and some of those things completely. But overall, remove those things that are not contributing to your success and achievement. And a good place to begin, we're not going to take time to go there, but it's Philippians 4:8. Anything that doesn't line up with Philippians 4:8 is probably a pretty good indicator that it should probably be removed out of your schedule. The sixth principle is be decisive. Following are three consequences of indecisiveness. Think about it. It's like serving two masters. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 24. It could also be called double-mindedness. James chapter 1 and verse 8. And it can lead to lukewarmness. Revelations chapter 3 and verses 15 and 16. Indecisiveness and vacillation are time stealers. Abraham's servant, who was sent to find a wife for Isaac, he understood all of that. In Genesis chapter 24 and verse 49, he had found Rebekah there at the well, and he's now with Laban. He says, now if ye will deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. And if not, tell me that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. He says, let me go on my way. I don't want to waste any time here. Let's just get after it and do it. However, at the same time that you want to be decisive, you also don't want to be premature or rash or impulsive. Luke 14:28 through 32 would certainly illustrate that point. And the difference between decisiveness and impulsiveness is that the former is governed by wisdom and godly counsel, whereas the latter is governed by immaturity and foolishness. We're not going to have time to deal with the other three principles of time management that will help us, should help us in time management. I'll pick that up in the next message. But let's understand this with time running out here. And that is, again, that there is probably nothing more valuable in our personal lives. Nothing probably more valuable in our personal lives. I'm, of course, ruling out God's influence upon us himself. But outside of that which God has given us, there is nothing more important in our lives than the time that God has allocated to each of us. None of us knows how much that is. And therefore, we better make the best use of it. And it is indeed, let me assure you, a principle of biblical economics and our success. Let's stand and we'll close this in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you and praise and glorify you as our God, King, Judge, and Lawgiver. We thank you, Father, for our lives and the time that you have given us. Father, I thank you for the time that you've given each one of us in this room, the time that you've given us to this very moment. And Lord, we just ask that we would make the most of whatever time you've given.